Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
As a child, I stammered in most situations. In shops, in the classroom, at home, on the bus, or anywhere when I was trying to answer a simple question. I did it in front of strangers, but also with family and friends. People would watch with curiosity as I struggled to be understood. I would repeat sounds over and over, making strangulated noises. I'd pause, take a breath, or sometimes stop breathing altogether for a while. I'd burn with embarrassment. A listener might try to help by guessing the word. If they got it wrong, they might try another word. They might even have a go at finishing the entire sentence for you, sort of like a game of charades without the usual clues. On occasion, I'd just give up, the colour in my cheeks rising after my inarticulacy had attracted the attention of a small crowd. There were adults who seemed confident that they knew how to fix me. They'd tell me to slow down, to breathe deeply, to say it again. One teacher would stop me mid-sentence and suggest that I think about what I was going to say. "Now say it," he would command excitedly. He seemed convinced of his technique, and I used to feel bad about disappointing him. Boys could be unkind, imitating the sounds, having a great snigger. Sometimes you'd hear them saying "b-b-b-" as your voice seized up. They would think this was very funny, even the 20th time around. One teacher used to let me struggle for ages with an answer before giving out a theatrical sigh and saying, "Next." Another imitated me in front of a primary school class to raise a laugh. But I discovered quite young that you don't stammer when you sing. There was a lot of music in my house. My father was a professional musician. My mother was in a choir, and she sang along to songs on the radio at home all the time. For me, singing was the most normal thing in the world. Talking was the problem. One evening in a Wexford hotel on a holiday at the age of 8, the guests began singing their party pieces. My mother suggested that my brother and I would sing. I didn't feel nervous. I felt excited. We sang The Last Waltz by Engelbert Humperdinck, which had been a big hit a few months earlier. The room went silent after we delivered the first line, and my brother and I, aged 8 and 9, then sang in full this song of ballroom heartbreak. I remember sustained applause, loads of compliments, and a request that we sing it again later before everyone broke up for the night. More applause, more compliments. I was hooked. When you sing, even if you're a stammerer, other people's words come flowing out perfectly. You can put expression into the words. You can raise the volume and lower it. You can speed up, slow down, put in an unexpected change in rhythm. You can express more in a song than you can ever say with mere spoken words. Songs make the people listening to you choke up sometimes. Not many speeches do that. I'm not alone in this. Carly Simon began to stammer when she was 8 years old, and she quickly discovered the liberation offered by singing. She said, "I felt so strangulated talking that I did the natural thing, which is to write songs, because I could sing without stammering, as all stammerers can." Ed Sheeran stammered until his father bought him an Eminem record, and he began rapping along fluently to it over and over. Elvis Presley, Noel Gallagher, B.B. King, Bill Withers, Jim Kerr, Mark Almond, all of them stammered, but not when they sang. Kylie Minogue was first encouraged to sing as part of her speech therapy. I think I know why this is. To sing a song properly, you need to take on a new persona, to sound like you are the person who felt the feelings that led to those lyrics. For 3 or 4 minutes, you can leave yourself behind. You are someone else, a person who doesn't stammer. It's why stammering actors become fluent on stage. I was one of that generation of UCD students who sat in the dark at lunchtime concerts in Theatre L, listening to Cork singer-songwriter Freddie White, not just singing, but owning the songs of Warren Zevon, of Randy Newman, Guy Clark and others. I know several of those songs off by heart now, and sometimes, late of an evening, in front of people who have drink taken, I'll sing a couple of them, and for a few minutes I'll kind of become the person who wrote them. Singing used to help me forget that I stammer, but during the best songs, you can forget who you are altogether. When I'm not singing, I know that monster remains hidden inside me, waiting to grab and strangle my speech mechanism at any time. The good news for stammerers out there, an estimated 8% of the population, is that this usually improves as life goes on. You can learn techniques and tricks. Most of us develop a high level of fluency as adults. It doesn't bother me much now. I know the words and sounds that will cause the trouble, and while speaking, I'm already seeing a sentence ahead, spotting the troublesome words coming towards me and finding substitutes before I get there. But when I sing, all this exhausting calculation becomes unnecessary. And one more thing, you'll notice I didn't need to sing this script. That's because, for whatever reason, you don't stammer when you're reading aloud.
I wonder, should I go or should I stay? The band had only one more song to play. And then I saw you at the corner of my eye. A little girl alone and so shy.
We were in Milan to attend Lucia di Lammermoor, the famous tragic opera by Donizetti. By evening, as the light began to fade, we felt the buzz of excitement building in the city. As we walked purposefully towards the entrance to Teatro alla Scala, dressed in our most sparkling attire, we noted the elegant patrons all around, robes flowing like sails, dickeybows of every hue striking notes of sartorial flair. The style was to die for. It was Milan, after all. Lucia di Lammermoor was first performed in Naples in 1835, and nearly 200 years later, after being postponed due to COVID, La Scala was staging a much-anticipated production with a long-promised starry cast. I'd familiarised myself with the opera's story. I'd listened on YouTube to Pavarotti and Joan Sutherland sing the famous duet in the first act, where they proclaim their love and promise they will always cherish each other. On the breeze will come to you my ardent sighs. Verano a te solauri me sospiri ardenti. I was intrigued to learn that the opera was based on a true story that had taken place in late 17th century Scotland. Janet Dalrymple was a young noblewoman who was in love with a political enemy of her family, but was forced to marry another man. She stabbed the bridegroom on the wedding night and died later of a hysterical fit. Sir Walter Scott modified the details and wrote The Bride of Lammermoor, which was published in 1819. This, in turn, inspired Donizetti, who created his powerful opera. The foyer of La Scala was buzzing. Tickets to the performance had sold out months before. We walked under sparkling chandeliers in the glittering foyer and were ushered in through gilded doorways. A young Madonna dressed in black and wearing a large medallion to denote her role directed us up the stairs, where we were greeted at the top by a young man, also in black and with a medallion around his neck. He beckoned us to follow him along a sweeping corridor of doors. We ran like sheep trying to keep up until he stopped outside one door and pulled out a key. Unlocking the door, he stood back and with a shy smile directed us into our box. Inside, with a great woomph, the red and gold amphitheatre opened up before us. From our velvet seats, we watched the audience filing in, beginning to take their seats. Our box was so close to the red curtain, I could nearly touch it. Glad I'd worn my long green satin skirt and gold top, I imagined I was living in the years of La Belle Époque. Before the overture began, another guest was ushered into our box. Sonia, a New Yorker, originally from Peru, joined us. She didn't know much about opera, she admitted, only that her countryman, the tenor Juan Diego Flores, was on the billing. He's a huge star both at home and around the world, she told us, speaking lovingly about the charismatic performer. Then the lights went low. Sonia settled in quietly beside us to watch the action, and the stirring notes of Donizetti's music began to unfurl. There was Lisette Oropeza, the radiant American soprano of Cuban heritage, and there was Diego. They sang together as the lovers Lucia and Edgardo. Edgardo had vowed to wage war against her family, but was stayed by his love for her. He would not use violence. Sulla tomba c'è rinsera il tradito genitore, even though he'd sworn on his father's tomb to wreak vengeance on her family. The proximity, the intimacy and honesty of their voices, the sweeping cadences and gorgeous bel canto lines, the magic of the theatre and the power and complexity of this age-old art form stole over me. I lost my heart to all of them. I was swept along by the transportive power of the music. I watched Lucia plead with her brother Enrico, begging him not to marry her off. I watched her reappear like a ghost in a blood-smeared bridal dress in the third act. When she thought she saw Edgardo, even as her heart broke, she sang, "Oh, me felice, Edgardo, Edgardo, oh, me felice, oh, how happy I am." When the music drew to a close, the cast bowed. The red curtain came down and the whole amphitheatre burst into rapturous applause. We all stood up, clapping as the principals re-emerged to take their bows. It was then that the shy Peruvian Sonia, beside us in the box, erupted. "Diego, te amo," she cried passionately. "Diego, te amo." Is it any wonder we too declared our love? "Diego, Diego, te amo," we each cried with gusto, like the star-crazed fans we'd become.
Sulla tomba che rinserra il tradito genitore, al tuo sangue eterna guerra io giurai nel mio furore. Ma ti vidi in cuor mio.
Next stop, St. Stephen's Green, a light for Grafton Street shopping district. And here's Tadele, Fahestievna, Thorling the Chanter Shopadorichta, Royd Grafton. I'm on the phone as I travel into the city centre. "I can't hear you," says the person at the other end. "It's very noisy." The noise is the sound of my own voice on the Lewis tram system, announcing our arrival at St. Stephen's Green. I travel by Lewis every day to various parts of Dublin city. People often ask me how it feels to hear my own voice announcing the stations and telling me to stand back from the door. People don't pay much attention to that one, I find. I'm so used to it now, it doesn't bother me at all. For a while, when I first recorded those announcements many years ago, I was nervous that I'd got something wrong and that I'd be mortified. Indeed, I did get one thing wrong with the name of a particular tram stop. To be fair, it was an unusual pronunciation used only by locals, but once it was pointed out to me, it niggled at me for a long time, and eventually I got to change it. And then there are the Irish language names. Oh, what a minefield that is. People often moan to me when they think something is wrong, and I've been a thorn in the side of the Lewis people on occasion when I complained that a version they've asked me to record might not be accurate or not commonly used. I've won some of these arguments, and I've lost some. There's rarely a definitive answer anyway when it comes to place names. As a person whose first career was as a broadcaster and whose experience in that world straddles decades, I find it odd that there's now a whole new generation of people who only know me as the voice of the Lewis. All that slaving to produce and present memorable radio and TV programmes over the years might never have happened. But it was my Lewis notoriety that led the talented young musician Rachel Lavelle to ask me to lend my voice to a track on her recent album, which was a great pleasure to work on. And I've been asked by complete strangers to record birthday greetings in my Lewis voice. Unless you use your voice professionally, you might not realise the importance it has in making an impression on other people. Most people take their voices for granted and rarely take any steps to improve their quality or to use them more effectively, or even to ask trusted friends for an opinion on how they use them. With so much communication now depending on the human voice rather than on the written word, the careful nurturing of the voice from an early age can make a big difference to how people get on in life. I'm not talking about teaching young children vocal exercises, but about adults speaking clearly and slowly to them when they're babies, even before they can talk. Children will replicate what they hear from parents, and if the parent or guardian is a mutterer or a gabbler, the child has a good chance of turning out the same. The days of school elocution lessons are long gone, so parents and guardians, school and media, are what influence speech habits these days. Accents are another minefield, and they too are influenced by the same factors. Whether we admit it or not, we all have prejudices related to accent, so that a person's accent can not only be a barrier to understanding, but also used as an unfair and unjustified indicator of social status and even employability, though I think that's changing. I love the variety of accents we have in Ireland, and it saddens me to hear young people from different parts of the country beginning to sound all the same because of the strong influence of both social and traditional media. A friend of a friend, a voiceover artist abroad, was once asked by a car company to record in-car announcements for a new model they were launching. It coincided with her divorce being finalised, and not long afterwards, her ex-husband decided to celebrate his newfound freedom by buying himself a new car, an expensive one he planned to hang on to for some years. Imagine his dismay when he sat in, turned the ignition, and heard the voice of his former wife telling him what to do. For my own part, I was very touched when my husband, like me, a regular Lewis user, remarked that he hoped he would die before me, as he couldn't bear to hear my disembodied voice telling him where he was and what to do.
The admission by accomplished authors that even they occasionally suffer from writer's block is a reassuring counterbalance to the many stories of artists who have dashed off masterpieces at dizzying speeds. John Boyne apparently wrote the first draft of The Boy in the Striped Pyjamas in only 2.5 days. Arthur Miller wrote the first act of Death of a Salesman in one day. And in what is surely an unbeatable record for creative speediness, Paul McCartney wrote the melody of his classic Yesterday in literally no time at all. He awoke from a dream with the tune fully formed in his imagination. Something about this last exploit reminds me of the remark of the poet John Keats in a letter to his friend Benjamin Bailey. The imagination may be compared to Adam's dream. He awoke and found it true. However, Keats's imagination didn't always cooperate with his dreams. And like many authors, he knew a bit about writer's block. In early 1819, after struggling for 6 or 7 months with Hyperion, an ambitious epic poem in the style of Milton's Paradise Lost, he made the decision to abandon it, ironically, because he found it too heavily influenced by Milton. But at the end of April, and throughout May of 1819, Keats experienced an extraordinary surge of creativity. In the space of a few weeks, he wrote La Belle Dame sans Merci and all but one of the famous 6 odes on which his reputation is largely based. Of these, perhaps the best known is Ode to a Nightingale. Charles Brown, who shared a house with Keats in Hampstead, recalled in his memoir how a nightingale had built its nest nearby. Keats loved listening to it. One morning in mid-May, Keats took his chair from the breakfast table to a grass plot under a plum tree, where he sat writing for 2 or 3 hours. When he returned to the house, Brown noticed he had scraps of paper in his hand, which he was quietly shoving behind some books. Knowing that Keats was often careless about these scraps on which he wrote, using some as bookmarks and losing others, Brown decided to go snooping. He found that the 4 or 5 pieces of paper contained, as he puts it, his poetic feeling on the song of Our Nightingale, and with Keats's help, assembled the poem we know today. The armchair psychiatrist in me likes to attribute this period of creativity to Keats's love for a woman. A few months earlier, he'd made the acquaintance of the 18-year-old daughter of a Mrs. Braun, who had rented Brown's house for a short period. In a letter to his brother George, Keats describes this girl as beautiful and elegant, graceful, silly, fashionable and strange, but admits we have a little tiff now and then. Later, he complains to George that she is monstrous in her behaviour and refers to her as a minx. This beautiful, elegant, monstrous minx, about whom Keats is protesting too much, methinks, was Fanny Braun. She became the love of his life. In April of 1819, Mrs. Braun and her family, including Fanny, moved into the house adjoining Keats's. Evidence that the daily contact he had with Fanny lifted his spirits can perhaps be seen in the restrained eroticism of La Belle Dame sans Merci, which Keats includes in a letter to George, dated the 28th of April. May saw the outpouring of the odes, including Ode on a Grecian Urn and Ode to Melancholy. By the end of the year, Keats and Fanny were engaged, albeit unofficially, given Mrs. Braun's reservations concerning his poor financial prospects. His many letters to Fanny, which usually open with "my dearest girl" or "my sweet girl," are as full of tender affection as they are of practical advice. In one, he warns her to be careful of open doors and windows and to be sure to wear her duffel coat. But Keats's health was deteriorating. One night, in early 1820, he started coughing and spitting blood, some of which stained his bedsheets. He asked Brown to bring a candle. "I know the colour of that blood," Keats said to him. "It's arterial blood. That drop of blood is my death warrant." Realising that another English winter might be his last, he allowed his friends to persuade him to quit England for Italy, for the sake of his health. He bade a sorrowful farewell to Fanny, knowing that it was unlikely they would ever meet again. Accompanied by a friend, Joseph Severn, Keats arrived in Rome in November 1820, after a gruelling sea journey. His health continued to worsen, and he was soon confined to bed. Broken-hearted and dying of consumption, he could not bear to open a letter that arrived from Fanny. His last weeks were miserable. His doctor had insisted on a course of regular bloodletting and a starvation diet of 1 anchovy and a morsel of bread per day. When he knew death could not be far off, the 25-year-old poet, who considered his life a failure, made 2 final requests concerning his burial. Firstly, to have carved on his gravestone not his name, but the most self-effacing of epitaphs: "Here lies one whose name was writ in water." Secondly, to have the last unopened letter from Fanny placed inside his funeral shroud, over his heart.
Thank you. He and I are so different. He's dark and reserved, wears grey and black. I'm red-haired, I wear reds and oranges, greens and blues, all the jewel colours. I'm the eternal optimist, impulsive, sometimes reckless. He's wise, unobtrusive, observant, cautious. I dance even when there are people looking. He rarely dances at all. We love a lot of the same things, though. We love Ireland. During the lockdown, we walked and walked our 2 kilometre radius and agreed over and over again that if you have to be locked down, this was the best 2 kilometre radius in the whole wide world. When our radius expanded a little, we would walk Dunleary Pier and look back at this little bit of the country we love with our hearts wide open. We have it all, he would say, holding my hand. But when there was music in the bandstand and I started to dance, he shook his head and kept walking. He wouldn't make a spectacle of himself, even for me. We love a lot of the same music, but my passion for Bruce Springsteen is not something he shares. I've loved Bruce since a boy I knew from Irish college. Hello, John Simon, if you're out there, wrote me a 4-page letter about the electrifying effect Hearing the River had had on him. I immediately went to the record shop where they allowed us to sit at the counter and listen to records, even though we were young teenagers who hardly ever bought anything. I listened to that whole album, and when I heard the lyric, "Let there be sunshine, let there be rain, let the broken-hearted love again," it spoke to my tender teenage sensibilities. I saved up my babysitting money and bought The River on cassette. Since then, Bruce Springsteen's been a staple on the soundtrack to my life. The great affection he has for his Irish audiences is meaningful to me. When The Boss recorded live in Dublin, I took it deeply personally, in a good way. I've something of a phobia for big crowds, so as a rule, I prefer to give myself up to the experience of music at home. For a Bruce Springsteen concert, though, I make an exception. To be with thousands of other people who are feeling what I'm feeling, moved by this musician's energy and poetry, is as close as I've ever been to the presence of God on this planet. Even so, my work plans meant when Bruce last played Dublin at the RDS, I didn't get a ticket. Then my schedule changed and I got an earlier flight home. I got back to my little flat where the man I love was waiting for me, and the music of the singer I worship could be heard floating across the park. He had never seen me like this. I was lit up with the excitement that that was Bruce, live, that we could hear coming in the windows. He gave up the idea of getting me to settle down for a night in and suggested instead that we walk closer to the RDS. And as we walked through the park, the sun was setting. We could hear the music more clearly. There were people dotted around picnicking, here to hear the concert for free at a distance. I alternated between trying to explain to him what the music means to me and singing along so that he could appreciate the beauty of the lyrics. We got as far as the Dodder Path and discovered a little group gathered there. We could see Bruce Springsteen on the jumbotron through the leaves of the trees, and the music was clear and audible now. He put his arms around me and we stayed a while. But it wasn't ideal. People were shifting in front of us, seeking better views and blocking ours. Others were chatting and smoking, which they had a perfect right to, but it marred it for us. After a while, I nodded at him and we started to drift homewards. But some Bruce Springsteen songs will always make me want to dance, and one of them started up before we got back across the park. I started dancing, and then, under the cover of the dusk, he did too. He danced in public, not because he loved Bruce Springsteen, but because he loved me. A little while ago, he decided that an introvert like him can't stay with an extrovert like me, and we parted ways. But I still have that moment in time when we were just dancing in the dark. And I hold on to the belief that Bruce spoke the truth when he said that there will be sunshine and there will be rain and the brokenhearted will love again.
This is a poem I wrote for my brother on his wedding day. He asked me to give a speech on behalf of our late father, Hanny. But instead of trying to figure out what our father might have said, I instead imagined what he might have felt in the form of a poem. The poem is called Horizons. Look at you now, all grown to fill a tux. My son married, a small boy no longer. And all they say about apples and trees, with a lovely wife to make you stronger. Days in the garden with the summer breeze, do you celebrate those old memories? The horizon changing colour and we, the great constructors of all that we see. A good father is who you've grown to be, with soundness of judgment to exercise. I swell with pride to see you with your bride, drinking happiness from each other's eyes. Together now, you will take your next stride to your horizon as husband and wife. You are the singing authors of your song. I wish you both joy for your whole lives long. When you wrinkle and reach my frozen age, do not fumble with the midlife crisis. Still years between you and that horizon, with woolly jumpers and bedtime vices. As shadows grow and stretch, so you'll wizen. But remember, play with my grandchildren. Tell them I'm here. Tell them to look and see. On the far side of the horizon, that's me.
On this morning's programme, we heard You Don't Stammer When You Sing by Mark Brenock, A Night at the Opera by Catherine Foley, Lewis Lady by Dejan Nivrien. The Letter on the Heart was by Cunnel Hamill. Dancing in the Dark by Mary Kate O'Flanagan. And Horizons, a poem by Duram Mustaha. The music was The Last Waltz by Engelbert Humperdinck. An extract from Act 1 of Donizetti's Lucia de Lammermoor, sung by Juan Diego Flores and Lisette Oropesa, with the chorus and orchestra of Teatro della Scala, conducted by Riccardo Cialli. Talking Loud and Clear by Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. The Nightingale and the Rose by Sansong, sung by Gwen Catley and the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Hugo Rignold. And Johnny Cash's song, Further On Up the Road, performed by Bruce Springsteen and the Sessions Band, live in Dublin. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. You can listen back to this morning's programme on the RTE radio app or at the programme website. And for more from this and other RTE arts and culture programmes, see rte.ie/culture.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.